Journal to David Thorne, Reel 10. You're saying that there were good things about Cranwell. What was so good about Cranwell?
Well, what was very good about Cranwell is that I had to conduct and teach in a war studies team which was involved in producing students who would take a general degree in war studies at London University under one of the great historian gurus. I'm having a blank on who it was, but
Michael Howard.
Mm. Thank you. And my subject was armoured warfare. And of course, to teach it to degree standard when you're an infantryman, you really have to get into armoured warfare. You really have to understand it. And it taught me a whole area of warfare, which really I hadn't had to be involved in at all. It was extremely timely because I was about to go, I didn't know it at that time, but about to go immediately after to be a company commander in a mechanized battalion with 4-3-2s in the British Army of the Rhine. So anyhow, what happened was I spent this 2 years reading people like Gorkowitz and really understanding for the first time the interplay between the weight of armour and speed, gun performances, simplicity of design, all the problems that the British have got into with their designs, the virtues of the T-34 tank. You know, you look at the T-34 tank and you look at a Kalashnikov and you begin to realise that the Russians were a genius for creating things that worked. And all of this was education at the time when I'd just been through the staff college and you thought you'd learned everything. Actually, I got into a depth of study and a level of interest and I became extremely fluent at teaching this subject. So, tremendously good. And the other thing, which really, in a sense, you only realize when you probably finished your army career and you're the project director of the National Skills Festival in the year 2000 and you want to get some help from the Ministry of Defence. And who do you go to but the Deputy Chief of the Defence Staff, who was one of your cadets at Cranwell, and the Member for Personnel, who was one of the other cadets.
That, of course, is a long-term and unforeseeable benefit.
Absolutely, but it turned out to be an enormous benefit. Mm. And so several members of the Air Force Board now are people who were my cadets in 1963-64.
You mentioned reading Gorkowitz about armoured warfare. Do you remember what other authors you read which had a particular impact on you?
Not to some extent, because Gorkowitz is all about design.
It's very conceptual, isn't it?
Which led to an understanding of, you know, because Gorkowitz concentrated upon a lot of the designs of the 1930s and early 1940s and traced the advance in British armour, Russian, American, French, and all the people who fancied themselves as one World War One or being the forefront didn't seem to follow through sufficiently. The Germans had the itch because they'd been defeated. You know, it was almost a lesson in psychology. And we didn't follow through on Fuller and people like that. We had a period of turpitude almost. And we weren't given enough money in the early 1920s. And the army was run down enormously. And your great figures were pleased with themselves because they'd won the war, and the great criticisms of the British general staff had not really seeped through the system sufficiently then.
Did you read Fuller himself?
Yes, I read Fuller.
Do you remember which of his works?
Little Heart. But it was a Gorkowitz that really impressed me. Because it was so clinical, so observant, so scientific. I mean, he isn't a name that strikes great echoes in people's mind, probably. Like, for a little heart. And yet he was very focused on what produced Purana.
Was armoured warfare the main thing you taught at Cranwell, or was it one of many topics?
It was one of two or three topics, and the progress of World War II was one of the others. And of course it interplayed very well with the developments in armoured warfare and so on. So World War II and elements of World War I, but really principally it was the between the wars period, it was World War II, and it was in particular the Western Desert, which again interplayed with armoured warfare.
What was the method of instruction at Cranwell, and how did it compare with the methods that have been employed to teach you at Sandhurst?
Well, I think very conventional. Basically, as far as I was concerned, I would have a group of degree students, and I would explain to them, to begin with, rather like a tutor, how I was going to take them through what they had to do and what was expected of them. I would suspect it was much more a classroom-type instruction than you would get at university, because they were also learning to fly, they were doing various other things, and, you know, it was a much more disciplined environment than in a university. But they all seemed to get goodish results, so our system wasn't bad. And I had lesson plans and information and reading, which I had to pick up and develop as I went through the 2 years. I got better and better, more and more lucid, and more and more understanding of what were the real points that need to be made, and the real points that these are the logical progressions that needed to be illustrated, out of which you could come deductions, and out of which you could develop papers yourself. That took me time. In a sense, they were a little vulnerable when I first got them, because I was actually learning on my feet and trusting the notes that I'd been given, which weren't bad, but they didn't mean so brilliant. Mm.
And how many people would you have in a class?
8, I recall, was the maximum.
And were you teaching by instruction or by discussion, by the seminar method?
A lot of discussion. I would talk to them in general terms, give them something to read, and then get them to write something, and then have discussion. So they'd have had to think their way through, they'd have had to do some studying, and then we'd have discussion.
Did they have to do formal presentations at any stage?
Yeah.
What sort of things would they present on?
Certainly in World War II, and you're straight into in the Western Desert, things like Hana, it's extremely well documented and very well supported by film and photographs and all the best means of sort of illustrating the sort of ground level effects of the war. And of course, actually in the Western Desert, there was a very good air battle to be discussed and the influence of that. So, yeah, there was material there, and there was a good library. There was film that we could get in. Funny enough, the AKC was extremely good at producing us. They'd got this material in our archives, and we used to draw on that constantly.
What about things such as close air support and in the Western Desert? Do you remember focusing on that?
I tend to deal with the land warfare, and the air war was dealt with by the staff officer from the Royal Air Force, but an American, and there was a naval officer. the American used to pick up, I did the land side, the American used to really act as a sort of a coordinator, team manager, and would pick up when we were on leave and do things for us. But he was really sort of a backup, an extremely good guy. Who then went to Vietnam and was killed. It's a stark reminder of the Americans were fighting in Vietnam at the time, and he went down. I think touched the wingtip and military Pentagon he was on. Mm.
So he was an Air Force man?
He was an Air Force. Mm. There were two Air Force, American and British, a naval officer, with a beaming voice, gunnery officer, with Brian Stark.
What did he teach?
He taught naval warfare and the naval aspects. And I suppose there was a certain amount of latitude, as long as Michael Howard was happy with the general progress, and he would comment upon things through the director of studies and things like that. As long as that was okay, then we proceeded along. And I think Michael Howard thought it was, I think it was a very good adjunct to King's College and all that he was doing there, that he could progress that. Presumably he was doing it with a number of places, and Cranwell was one of them.
How did he actually keep in touch with what was going on?
Through the director of studies. He was really hardly in touch, basically. We just knew if we were going off track because of the results. I wonder how we didn't.
And was the director of studies an officer or was he a civilian?
He was an educator in the Air Force. He was on the map. He didn't have his name to come back to him, so he was on the map. 30 years.
While you were at Cranwell teaching, did you observe any significant differences between the Army mentality and the Royal Air Force mentality and outlook?
Oh, yes. Air Force mentality, much more focused upon the individual and and other aspects of flair and initiative, which the Army certainly don't ignore, they encourage, but the Army is so much about corporate teamwork. And the Air Force, particularly among the pilots, is about individual courage and individual focus and technical intelligence and technical ability. And so, yes, that started to come through pretty early on. And I got involved with, like I mentioned to you before, running that cricket and their squash. They were very good to me. They got me involved in everything. I was then playing cricket for the Army and things. I played squash for the Army. And from Norfolk. And so, in a sense, I was known as a good sportsman. But they also got me much involved in their adventure training side, because every cadet went up in a camp. And I was responsible for a certain group of cadets, who were number 90, I'm sure, I think it was. And so I got to know them especially well. And one of the most satisfying times I had that was going to adventure training in Germany. And my particular team won the sort of intersection competition, which included the first march, which was a very hard one, and in which at one stage they thought they were losing, and I remember getting them together and saying to them, look, you want to understand that the others are laughing at you. They think you're beaten. And it had exactly the effect I wanted, which had got them really fired up. And they proceeded to carry the day. And I think they learned a lot from that, because they knew I was firing them up quite a little bit. And I'm a very competitive sort of person, and they were conscious of that too. So in a sense, they learned something about encouraging people to do things that they don't actually want to do, but they suddenly find they want to do them very, very much indeed, because they're part of a team.
So the firing up worked, even though they knew you were winding them up?
Oh, yes. Mm. They knew. I was very straight about it. I said, you know, you don't understand. These people are laughing at you.
Well, where were they actually doing this? Where did they tend to do these adventure training?
But it was in the... in the southwest of Germany, in among the hills there. And I wish I could remember the name of the place, but it was a lovely area. We did rock climbing, canoeing, escape and evasion, excellent escape and evasion. And when I became a company commander later, I kept in touch with the College of Cranwell, and I did their escape and evasion for them one year myself.
Was that you playing enemy?
Enemy, yes. Mm. So before I was involved, and of course, involved with the cadets doing the escape and evasion, which was also very good for me, and very, you know, very enjoyable, very absorbing exercise, being trying to escape and evade. And then it was lovely to set about doing the opposite for them 18 months later, 2 years later. Mm.
Did they do any straightforward infantry training at this time?
No. Mainly character building.
How was that done? What was the...
Well, basically, getting out in the Pennines and places like that, doing some pretty hard marches, learning to use a compass properly, learning to survive, sensibly instructed, and then these camps which happened at the end of each summer, somewhere over a fortnight or 3 weeks at camp. And that was very productive time in terms of learning to get to know them and then getting to know themselves. Mm. But I would say their real training was much more to do with flying, and because this was very much a pilot's place, and then jet provost, which they took me up and delighted in trying to be sick from there. Up, straight up, straight down.
Violent evolutions.
That's right, and funny enough, the guy who is the and personnel of the land was one of the guys who tried hardest to get me to be ill, and who had stayed, you know, been in touch with and stayed friends with all the time.
How much notice did you have of your next move?
Quite a lot, because it must have been 6 months. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is because at the same time, the 1st Battalion, early on in my tour at Cranwell, were moved out rapidly to Aden, and I applied to go and join them. And I didn't just slap their toys, I don't know what they were doing. Mm-hmm. But as soon as they came back, I'd been able to complete my 2 years, and I was the 1st Battalion man, and so they said, right, you know, I knew I was going back very early on.
Mm. And where were they when you joined them?
They had just moved back from Aden, had passed through England, and had arrived in Salah. And they'd been there about a fortnight, and I joined them ahead of everybody else. So the advance party was there when I arrived. And so I had about a fortnight of settling in myself with family and the advance party. And then in they came.
Did you notice any differences in them from having been to Aden, or from having your having been away from them?
Not really, because I stayed in touch with them in all kinds of ways. And so I think what I found out gradually in the first 6 months is there were some pretty hardened characters in there who'd been through Aden, who were very powerful thinkers. And I think that's what first caught my eye, is that tucked away in the support weapons platoon, there were some people who really needed to drain out, that they we had a pretty good retention rate for probably very senior safeties, and that some of them had never been in a mechanized battalion before, an APC-born battalion, and the 4-3-2s were new, and so there was a real intellectual step-up they had to make, and some of them really couldn't make it. Some of the corporals just couldn't make it. And then others who got GCSEs and so on, they just came whipping through, real red-hot. Mm-hmm. In terms of managing the vehicle and the ready procedures and so on and so forth. And so you had a gentle adjustment had to go on. So the excellent guys who couldn't really cope but were bloody good soldiers on the ground, foot soldiers, they moved into the Pavo section or moved into a place where they could do an excellent job, weren't required to stand up in an APC, command that, and order the driver around, and respond to the company commander on a company net, and generally keep their ears pinned, and control that section behind, under, you know, all buttoned down, who have to bloody well up ever since they hit the ground. And that's quite a task for anybody. It's a real leadership task, and is more a leadership task, really, in many ways, than just being a section commander on foot, depending on the hardness of the task. Foot soldiering is probably the hardest of all, if the weather conditions are bad and the ground is difficult.
Well, presumably foot soldiering is more physically arduous, but if one's thinking about the mental side of it, then the demands are greater if you're having to try and command a vehicle as well as a section of men.
Absolutely. And that's where we had to make a sort of a transition as a battalion from a very and we had a very professional commanding officer, Tim Creasy, who later became CNC UKLF, and was a hard taskmaster, very professional.
Presumably also, if you're riding in a vehicle, you have to be quicker thinking than if you're moving on foot for station keeping purposes.
You have to be quicker because everything's moving faster. Things happen in the sense they actually happen much quicker. So you've got to listen all the time, you've got to read the battle. A lot depends upon the company commander and his discipline and the platoon commander as to how they communicate with their section commanders, who, in a sense, are constantly listening, and the people in the back of the vehicle are listening, and they get a lot of a feel for what's happening through the internal internal communications within the vehicle, and the canal system, the loudspeaker systems in the vehicle. And then, of course, you get into the whole business of maintenance of the vehicle, because you never look more foolish than if your vehicle is always long breaking down. Get to be hauled in by the unit detachment and gunners, and everybody's laughing at you. You're in a sense, you're very much under pressure as a corporal, a section commander, commanding a 4-3-2.
Presumably, also as a company commander, you're under additional pressure. Because,
and it's really thrilling.
Yeah.
Because things move quickly, and because, well, I mean, we ate for long. Absolutely. So you get good company commanders. And they said, well, I knew a lot about Army Warfare. We had units around us who were not used to this kind of very upfront. I'm not going to be pushed around by anybody. And of course, the infantry actually were being pushed around by the Army Corps and others. But not us. I will remember getting out. The first exercise we did with the 11th Hussars was a smashing bunch. But had been in Germany a hell of a long time, and very quickly they knew who they'd got, because I was commanding A Company. So they arrived out in the training area, and my platoon commanders, one of them, a chap called Colin Simpson, who played rugby for England at the age of 18 and so on, and his platoon sergeant was Sergeant Carpenter, who'd been the middle of boxing champion. Well, they made the big mistake of the 11th Hussars of when Colin got his APC stuck in the bomb and refusing to help him out. So he climbs on board the tank, his present concern, picks the commander up by the scruff of the neck and brings him out of his tank, by which time the commander was going to do anything he possibly could to get Colin Simpson. And everybody's seeing it going on across, and they can see, little legs, held above the ground, and being told, get it out. And the second incident was in, the 11th Hussars very quickly sort of cotton mantles, and the second incident was actually doing some patrolling against them. And some reason or other, one of the 11th Hussars in that patrol tried to take on the side of the car, and across. Was laid horizontal on the spot. After which we got on like a house on the top, because we were also very professional and we challenged them with other stuff. And when I was working with them, if they got a grip on me, I immediately whipped that and got a grip of them as a commanding officer or anybody. And as a result, they knew they'd got operators with them. And the company knew that in a sense I was in a very strong position as a neural actor, and I knew exactly what was happening, and if they gave me rubbish for my particular company combat team, they sent me rotten tanks, I'd be saying so to them immediately, and to the commanding officer, and they'd hear it all going on over and out. And absolutely. So there was no quarter given, and eventually the Royal knew they'd got an extremely competent bunch with them, and that's through the whole of the battalion. So we made a reputation for her very quickly.
How long did it actually take, do you think, to get the soldiers, and in particular the junior NCOs, used to the 432?
3 months. Mm. And intensive work, extremely rewarding, and if you do it slower than that, they get bored.
What was actually in the programme of training for adaptation to this mechanised role?
Well, I mean, you just go through you start with the tactics, it's how you get out of the vehicle effectively.
How do you do that?
Well, you make sure that there's a leader at the front and there's a leader at the back, and that they get up very fast and they get out dispersed from the vehicle and get down immediately, and not too far away from each other, right? And then the vehicle gets out of it, and this is some bloody good reason, because that's their precious taxi, and they don't want that getting up, and of course it's a signal as to where you are. So, I mean, those are the two simple actions. You get out with all your kit, in good order, get down, leader's in the right position, one is sort of probably second out rather than first, because you know, first command going over the trouble, second out of the vehicle, leading, getting out, and the guy bringing up the rear, and quite often the commander might get in, probably have to get back into the back to beat his guys while the driver was finishing off the maneuver, coming to a halt, but they never stop, they've got to get out very rapidly, because that's extremely wonderful. After that, once you're out, then the aim, the only sort of important thing about your vehicle is it should be legal, where it is relatively safe and under control, you're a sergeant major and etc. etc. It's very kind of the conventional stuff, but it need to be done with a good nose. And so that's the debussing bit.
Presumably, after getting out, if the vehicle's then going to move, you've got to avoid the vehicle running over the guys who are lying doggo.
So that's the driver.
Yes.
And with his number two, who commands over once you're all out, he's got to do that. But let's also take a look at there's a whole issue of where and when you debus.
Quite.
And the further away from the position you debus, the further the infantry have got to get and carry their kit. And what the hell are you doing? So you choice of country and use of ground and use of surprise and being led in by tanks and being led in right onto the position is to my mind fundamental. And in which it's a company commander who's telling everybody what they're doing and no one else talks. And the company commander saying, we're going to say his orders are over there, they're taken over there, and they're probably taking the orders as they're moving forward. Right?
But the thing is that if you leave it too late, then you can get caught with the guys in the vehicles under anti-tank fire, and then you're in dead trouble because you're annihilated, aren't you?
So you've got to know.
You've got to get it absolutely right.
You've got to have good information, and you've got to read the ground, right? And you've got to have your tanks up to take the flag, and you've got to have a decent fire plan. And the key to that is a decent fire plan to cover you in as close as possible, then the tanks to fire you in, and you actually run through, if possible, the tanks to pile out.
Well, this is really, again, fundamentally, it's all arms, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Coordination.
Absolutely. Now, that's extremely interesting. And so for a battalion that's never done it, I'm an enormously nice. So we've had a tremendous 2 years, which everyone was mentally tested, became very much on the ball, very proud of their record of keeping their vehicles on the road, and we've got an excellent.
What was the 432 like, as a vehicle? What were its characteristics, operational and technical?
We could brew a good tea out of it. the number one.
Most important point of all.
Absolutely.
you make space for your kit, if you, as long as you've organised it properly.
How many guys could you get into it?
How many guys? Well, ideally,